The time we have for the two sessions tonight and a few hours in the morning, we're going to deal with five particular areas that are relevant to the idea of keeping balance in our marriage. And when you think about balance, you're thinking about an airplane. We flew over here two flights from Denver to Atlanta, about 2.5 hours, and then an hour and change from Atlanta to Palm Beach. And I'm so grateful that that pilot knows how to keep that left and that right wing about equal with one another and is able to adjust to keep it in the air until we're ready for him to land. Balance is so important. We can tend toward extremes. We live in a society of extremes. And so we're going to be looking at how to strike the balance in these different regards. First area we're going to deal with tonight that was assigned to me has to do with respect. And if it went to sleep or not, well, respect is like a black screen. Sometimes you think you have it and you don't, so we're getting our glitch out of the way up front. So there we go. There it is. A woman had a dog and she was trying to give it medicine. It was sick, needed it, and every day she was trying to force a tablespoon of medicine down its throat, and the dog always resisted and pulled away. One day the woman went to try to give the medicine, and she dropped the bottle, and medicine went all over the floor. Dog went over and licked it up immediately. See, it wasn't a problem with the medicine, it was the method. I ask people a lot when it comes to needs in a marriage and things that they value or things that are problems if they don't exist. And sometimes talk about what are the problem areas in marriage. And when I think about that, I have various areas that I like to cover. Money is a problem area in marriage, and most couples agree in one way or another throughout time. It's a factor in causing strain in a marriage. In-laws are a problem in marriage. Over-integrated relations in that regard can be a problem. Religion is a problem in marriage. I believe the principle is applicable. In Amos 3 and verse 3, can two walk together except they are agreed? And then communication is a problem. 90% of all people who seek marriage counseling, it is said, seek it because of some kind of communication problem. And then sex and children. Now, you put those together, it's somewhat of a logical tie, but those are the kinds of issues that drive people to seek help or their areas of problems in a marriage. But outside of those five, if there was another one that you could add to the list, it would have something to do with either trust or respect. And we'll see how those things are tied. And I think if I were to ask you, is respect something that you value in your relationship, almost all of us would say it's near the top of the list. The problem is sometimes we don't know how to go about getting respect. Sometimes we understand it's good medicine, but we are off on the method, aren't we? Isn't it possible for us to have some ways of trying to get respect from our spouse that are unhealthy ways, unproductive ways? Can you think of some unhealthy or unproductive ways in which a person in a marriage might be seeking respect? Some ways that you want respect that may not be the healthiest ways?
Demanding.
All right, demanding it. Asking no uncertain terms. So it's kind of the woman forcing the medicine down the throat, isn't it? All right, demanding it. What else? You want respect from your spouse. And here's the thing. You're going, I don't know if I want to answer because you don't think that that's what we're dealing with. Don't worry about that, okay? Everybody knows somebody else. So here it is. So demanding it.
No, that's not something I've tried.
Oh, no. See? Josh is the trailblazer. So now, guys, the bar's down here. How else might we try to get respect from our spouse? It's not healthy.
Not being flexible.
All right, so being rigid on our side. Asking the other person to do all the bending. All right? Anything else? Buying it. All right, we might even add with that bribery. I'm going, and akin to that might be manipulation. I'm going to do what it takes to get the end result out of you that I want. It's a little more indirect, a little more passive than forcing it down the throat, but it turns out to be a very similar thing in the end, doesn't it? How about guilt tripping? You know, you don't do such and such for me, A, B, or C, and so there's something wrong with you. You're flawed. There's a problem. And out of that, I'm going to try to get respect. Bribing browbeating, that might be similar to what it said. A false front, not putting forth what we really want and ordered, and that's akin to our manipulation. And yet respect is something very powerful in a marriage. In fact, I find it interesting, I don't know what version is used the most often here, but it's interesting that in the New American Standard Version, it's put this way. Anybody use the New American Standard Version? All right, but in 1 Peter chapter 3, if you'll turn over there with me, the Apostle Peter is speaking, and he's writing a lot about the fear that we ought to have for God. And he's writing to a people who were suffering from persecution and how that they needed to count the cost and endure the difficult now so that they could have those exceeding and precious promises that Peter talks about in the second letter. Or they could get the world's acceptance now and they could forego the prize that God has prepared for Christians. But in 1 Peter chapter 3, with that general background, you'll find Peter saying to women to begin in the chapter, "Beloved, I now write to you..." I'm sorry, go over to 1 Peter chapter 3. "Wives, likewise, be submissive to your own husbands, that even if some do not obey the word, they without a word may be won by the conduct of their wives, when they observe your chaste conduct accompanied by fear." Now, Cam, your version probably says they're chaste and respectful behavior. Now, it's interesting the word that Peter uses there. The word he uses there is the word phobos. When you hear that word, what does it make you think of immediately? Phobia, fear. Now, this particular word is an interesting word because when it's used, it is used to speak of a reverent and respectful awe of God. Now, the word will appear other places in the New Testament. In Acts chapter 9 and verse 31, the early church went on in the fear of the Lord. And in Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 28, we are to worship God acceptably with reverence and godly fear. Now, when you look at what Peter says here about the respectful behavior of the wife in 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 1 and 2, you'll notice that it's influential. In verse 1, "that man may be won to Christ without a word by the behavior that the husband sees from the wife." But not only is it influential, it's observable. In fact, in most versions in verse 2 says that he, as he observes her. And then the third thing you'll notice is that it's tangible. It's behavior. But the word respectful here, or with the fear in other versions, is a fear not for her husband, but it's a fear of God. And if both spouses will have a proper reverence and respect and fear of God, then especially if both of them are Christians, there's going to be a respect that's mutual, that happens between a husband and wife, that helps that marriage to have the balance that God wants it to have. But it's not surprising for us that marriage can bring disrespect, can it? Again, it's not necessarily something you've gone through, but you've heard from somebody else. There's a problem. It's a problem that happens in marriage. You have two different people who are expected by God to amalgamate into one. You have different traditions. You have different backgrounds. Different things that were prioritized in your family. Not all of that was sinful versus appropriate. Sometimes it was just different. And you're bringing those two personalities together and you're saying you're going to be one. And the thing is, so often in that environment, you're negotiating. You're this volatile combination of independence and dependence. And so in this, one or both of the spouses may be difficult, even overbearing and disrespectful. I'm going to give you some resources throughout the weekend, books I think are very valuable that you can write down if you want. I see some of you are taking notes. The first one is a book by Steve and Annie Chapman called "What Husbands and Wives Are Not Saying to Each Other." Maybe if you have your Amazon app, I'll tell you, that's an Amazon app searcher right there. What Husbands and Wives Are Not Telling Each Other. And in the course of the book, they interview several couples. And in this particular chapter, they're asking them about that domineering, that disrespectful behavior. And they interviewed some wives. And they interviewed a wife that had been married for 34 years. And she said of her husband, "He's passive-aggressive. I'm always trying to figure out how to please him without knowing what he wants. It's an impossible situation." Another wife had been married 13 years, and she said, "He owns his own business, and he controls every aspect. He never shares with me. He says, it's none of my concern." Another wife, married 17 years, says, "If I agree with my husband on everything, he's fine. If I don't, he thinks I don't love him, or that I'm going to leave him for someone else. I feel like when the kids are gone, we'll have nothing in common. But then they interviewed some husbands. And a husband who had been married for 30 years said, things need to go her way or she gets really moody. Boy, guys are not going to chuckle on this one there. A husband, 24 years married, said, my wife is very controlling. She says hurtful things in anger that she later regrets. Another husband, married 19 years, says everything has to be done on her timetable, regardless of what's going on with everyone in the family. It's all about her agenda. Now, here's an important point. These folks have been married for a while. Some of you have been married for a shorter period of time than others of you have, but it's not something that necessarily goes away with time, and we'll say that again. Developing a respectful relationship is something that is built day by day in the process of time. And if you're not practicing the things that takes for that early in the marriage, in the middle years of your marriage, in the later years of your marriage, you're going to still be dealing with those same fundamental issues. And we don't want to just survive our marriages. We want them to improve. We want them to thrive. And so a lot of that revolves around being respectful. We must respect the feelings and the thoughts and the ideas and the concerns and the priorities of our mates and not just feel that we have to constantly have our own way. I'm going to refer to the book of Philippians before we end this particular session, but in Philippians chapter 2, verse 3 and 4, the Apostle Paul says, do nothing from selfishness or empty conceit, but in lowliness of mind, let each esteem the other as better than themselves. Not look out for your selfish interests, but look out for the interests of others. Wouldn't you agree that that's a good principle for marriage? Paul's talking to the church. But don't do things from selfish ambition and conceit, but in humility. Seek the interest of the other person over yourself. But what does that look like? All right, so what I want to do is I want to, in this session, look at three ways, three areas in which we can build respect in our marriages. Here's the first area. Respect means that we think a certain way. Guys, let me paint a picture for just a moment. What does it look like to think in a way that's respectful toward your spouse? What are some examples of respectful thoughts or areas of respect? In what way do you need to respect her or him? Okay. And we'll take that first one. We're going to value a lot. You value them. You think in terms that you have esteem. You have respect for what they think, what they say. What else? How can you think towards your spouse in a way that's going to demonstrate respect? Appreciation. All right. You're able to count the blessings that they bring to the circumstance. All right. You look at them not as above or beneath, but one who's a partner, a helpmeet, one at the side. All right. An ability that allows us to step outside of ourselves and how we see things and try to think through their mind, try to look through their eyes. That's very good. So I want you to, as you start to stimulate those thoughts, I want us to think about an important truth the Bible always tells us. When you have problems in your life, where does it begin? In the heart. And so we're going to go from the place where the battle begins, where it's sometimes lost in the heart. And you'll think about what Solomon says in long ago, Proverbs chapter 4 and verse 23, keep the heart with all diligence, for out of it, anybody know? Are the issues of life. But then I think about what Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 5 and verse 8. Among those beatitudes that he lists for one in building the foundation of a disciple's life, he says in Matthew 5 and verse 8, blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Jesus is emphasizing the heart. He has a law that he lives that is an external law in that if one fell short of that law, there was not a sacrifice that would take care of that. He himself came and dying on the cross took that law out of the way and established his law. But he's always speaking to the religious leaders and is emphasizing the inside-out religion. And in Matthew chapter 15 and verse 18, he says something that really strikes at the heart of what we're talking about. He says, the things that proceed out of the mouth come from the heart, and these defile the man. For out of the heart comes evil thoughts, murders, adulteries, fornications, thefts, false witnesses, slanders. These are the things which defile the man. Now you look at that, that's behaviors as extreme and as unrighteous as they could be, but where do they all start? In the heart. And outside of murder, which does happen occasionally, sadly, in marriages, these other things are common things that can happen in a marriage. And they start in the heart. And so as we look at what Jesus says, he says they defile the man. This is the opposite of a holy and godly behavior. And Jesus traces the roots right back down to that spiritual pollution of the heart. You see, it's easy for us to let the world's standards and values and definitions to creep in and to dictate how we're to relate to one another. And because of the self-centered, the me-first world we live in, so often we find ourselves not respecting the other person because we're not putting ourselves in their shoes and trying to think empathetically. And there's a lot of different ways we could talk about that, but for the sake of time, I want to look at just one. Another resource, by the way, William Doherty, and his book is called Taking Back Your Marriage. Excellent resource. He calls this tendency consumer marriage. He says consumer marriage consumes our thinking. And he has a very spot-on analysis of how consumerism has slowly but surely infected our thinking in marriage, which too often we equate in some terms about buying a house or buying a car. And here's what he says the consumer culture says. The consumer culture says, number one, we never have enough of what we want. Right? Need more. Nobody's ever satisfied. Number two, don't be loyal to what no longer meets your needs. There are so many industries that rely on us thinking that way. And I'm not saying when it comes to being a consumer physically with regard to material things, those things are necessarily wrong. But it's the thinking I want you to look at. Number three, new is always better than old. Number four, am I getting a good deal? This is that cost-benefit ratio, right? For what I'm putting in, am I getting back what I need to get back from my investment? Now, does that affect marriages? Does this consumer mentality, can that creep in? I believe it can. I believe it does in a lot of different ways. I want you to consider them with me. Number one, I am not getting my needs met. Turning wants into needs is what drives a market economy, isn't it? Now, I'm going to give you a list of items, and I want you to tell me what they have in common. Here they are. Color television, or black and white television. Washer and dryer. Computer. Cell phone. Car. All right, what do they all have in common?
Electricity.
All right, electricity. It's a good answer. It's not the one I'm looking for. It's a good answer.
Technology.
Good. Everybody has one. Convenience.
They're all created to wear out.
These are excellent answers.
They've all improved over time.
So we could make a lot of different illustrations with this, but as good as those answers are, there's something else they have in common. Who said that? They're all wants. Give her a gold star. No, they're not needs. Wait a minute. How many of you commute to work? I mean a long commute. Is a car a need or a want? It's a need because of how our society has changed, certainly. But in the technical sense, you could get a horse. You could ride the bus, somebody else's vehicle. You could walk. You know, I read about the guy in Michigan that did that. Technically speaking, civilization survived without them for 5,900 years, right? Oh, I know TV, especially during football season. But it's a want. It is. It's a want. So as we look at these things, what has made those things in our minds so intrinsically need-oriented? It is that marketing mentality. Hey, and marketing is fine. It's a free market economy. We've got to have that. But it's dangerous when we start looking at our marriages that way. And so often what happens is we confuse our wants with needs. And we say, I need this out of a marriage. And we need to step back and say, am I letting this consumerism drive my thinking instead of the Word of God? You see, a Christian should not even be obsessed with those kinds of confusing matters, confusing those wants for needs. Now, on the other side of that, we say, I deserve better. I deserve better than I'm getting, than I'm being treated. Now, there are certain things that every husband and wife, on a very basic level, are entitled to in a marriage, right? What are some things that are basic rights of a marriage? Say it again.
Trust.
Absolutely. Try having a marriage without that.
Love.
Fidelity. Faithfulness. You see, freedom from abuse. We could add some things to that list. Commitment. That kind of goes along with that. And sexual faithfulness. Goodwill. Basic fairness that should be expected. But see, husbands and wives work themselves out of a marriage by being focused on being entitled to something that's different or better. In the process of time, we find ourselves going, well, as I'm growing and I'm improving, I don't see this and at the same level, and I deserve better than this. Number three, it's consumer thinking. If only I were married to that one. Here's what happens, you know, you especially and you walk into a church building, it's the same as a lot of, in fact, it can be more dangerous there. Because when you walk into a church building and you're getting ready to assemble on Sunday morning and you're filing past the pews to go to your seat and you look from your to your left or your right, what do you see? You see the husband and wife with their arms around each other and they seem so in love. Or you go to Facebook or Instagram or whatever your social media platform is, if you have one, and you see all that, you go, oh my. That's such a wonderful, if only I were married to that person. What's the problem with that thinking?
It's a lie.
It's a lie, number one. It's a facade. It's not true. But beyond that, what's wrong? Maybe that's the fundamental heart of it. Apart from that lie, it's the grass is greener, and it's not. It may be greener literally in some situations you can think of, but in marriage, it's not. You see, when you begin to analyze it, you don't know what it's like to be married to anyone other than your spouse. And whatever positive trait is that you might make, you're going to get a different set of flaws that you're going to have to deal with. There are certain things that you just cannot know until you're locked in the furnace of the marital bond. And you're going through things together. And so the best remedy is to think more positively and more respectfully, more often about your mate. See, that's consumerism that's driving our thinking when we say that. And here's one that's akin to it. My marriage is not as good as your marriage is. If you dwell on how happy and how in love other people are, you know where your focus is not? On what you and your spouse can do to make your marriage better. You begin to envy others. You begin to devalue your own marriage. But then another one is, my spouse is a flawed person. Never mind who's saying that, right? A flawed person. Because we're all flawed. But you know what? You get a new model, you get a different set of flaws. That's the way that goes. Ask yourself, are these flaws fatal? Or are they simply bothersome? Are they irreconcilable? Or are they reconcilable? And another thing to keep in mind is that acceptance of another person has a way of bringing out the very best in that other person. It's amazing when you set your focus on that. And somebody said appreciating the value of and the blessings of that other person, being thankful. When you do that, it's amazing how their stock rises as you look at them. A lot of times it's not external, it's internal. But then also, I'm the good guy here. That's the scorekeeping mentality. And we all have a great capacity for self-justification, don't we? And the easiest way to play the game of consumer marriage is to focus on your own righteousness while downplaying your own contribution to the problems that are existing in the marriage. Self-justifying thoughts prepare you for exiting or pulling back. But the problem is, you take those same tendencies in the next relationship that you go into. So what we got to do is we got to cut this off at the place where it starts, and that's in the heart. This disrespect that exists toward our spouse may be because we bought into the consumerism that's all around us that cannot apply to our marriage. The best way to find the roots, or the weeds rather, is to trace them back to their roots. The world may be influencing our thinking more often and in more ways than we think. We've got to be convicted that in the end result of human thinking, there's a dangerous end. There's a way that seems right unto a man, but the ends thereof are the ways of death and destruction. Proverbs 16:25. So, the first area in which we can be respectful in our marriage is to control the way that we think. All right, here's the second one, and it's the next area you think that you would go, and you go from the thoughts to the words. And it seems to me that a lot of the battles can be won on that first front. If we go into the heart and we trace it there and we stop it there, it's going to keep the marriage from having those problems, but we're human. And sometimes it gets past the heart stage and it gets to the mouth stage. And I think back to what Jesus says in Matthew 15 and 18 through 20. There are a lot of the sins that he mentions there, and he's talking about general relationships among people. But in marriage, it's the same way. Most of the things on that list in Matthew chapter 15, verse 19, are things that involve the tongue and our words. And if you look at Mark's parallel account, he adds another one that we'll be able to talk about a little bit, and that's deception in Mark chapter 7 and verse 22. All right, so there's three areas in which we need to divide this idea of thought, of words. The first is we need to be respectful in our speech, generally speaking. What are some ways we show disrespect in our speech? Not necessarily, don't think just in terms of your spouse, but disrespectful ways of communicating.
Sarcasm.
Condescendence. All right, condescendence.
Using words like always or never.
All right, are those extreme words? Always and never. That's good. So you think now these are things that may seep into other relationships. They're general patterns, habits that we fall into, and we begin to relate to other people in that way. And it may go better in some of the relationships, because if you're a sarcastic boss, they still have to listen to what you have to say there, and so you can maintain some kind of relationship there. But in some of the more intimate relationships, you may have noticed you've lost some friends in time because of that sarcasm. But you've kept some. But then there's your spouse, who doesn't have that freedom. That spouse stood before God and before witnesses and made a vow. And they have to endure some of those kinds of general ways of speaking. Now, we could build a list, a long list, but I want to mention just a couple of them. One that's a general tendency that can show up in disrespectful ways is grumbling and complaining. And that's one of those constant ongoing things that happens in a marriage relationship. And you think about how serious this is to God in our relationships. In Philippians 2 and verse 14, Moses and Aaron had to put up with the Israelites. And Paul would say to the church at Philippi, who apparently had an issue with that as well, do all things without grumbling and disputing. When you think back to Israel, it cost a whole generation their lives. You look at Numbers chapter 16 or look at 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and you see how that constant attitude caused God to just be revolted by it. And another one is bitterness. Some people are bitter people. And that starts in the heart but shows itself in the tongue. And when you define it in Ephesians 4 verse 31 talks about it, it's sharp, intense hatred or resentment. We need to be respectful in the way that we speak generally, because our spouses are the ones who hear it the most often. But then we drill it down and we get talking about some ways that deal with our speech with our spouse. And we talk about the need to be respectful in our speech toward our spouse. So how might we show disrespect in our speech to our spouse?
Criticism.
All right, and that and why is that disrespectful? All right, it devalues them. See, the word value gets bounced around here a little bit, and criticism minimizes the value of somebody. Says you're not as valuable as you need to be. What else?
Nagging.
Now that was a lady's voice. I'm sorry. I'm just kidding. Nagging, and guys nag too, right? Ladies, do guys ever nag? Okay, maybe not. All right. But lying. All right, that gets us right back to trust where we started, right? Very fundamental to respect. Lying is a major way in which we disrespect the other person, because we're violating them, we're hurting them, and not valuing who they are. In fact, it's on my list. Let me give you another one first. Clamor. This is in Paul's list in Ephesians chapter 4, verse 31. And given the raised eyebrow, let me let the Greek dictionaries define that for us. It's loud screaming or shouting. And Paul puts that in this category of behaviors that the church at Ephesus was not to engage in their relationship with one another. But I want you to think about, especially in this room tonight, we're talking about those who are not only husbands and wives, but we're brothers and sisters in Christ. And so this way of needing to relate to those who are in the body of Christ is most intimately needed in that relationship of husband and wife. So clamor again, loud screaming or shouting. And a different Greek word is used by Paul in Galatians chapter 5 and verse 20, and that's outbursts of anger. It's a similar idea, but it's with the implication of an intense anger and passionate outbursts. And Paul calls it a work of the flesh, and he puts it alongside such things as fornication and adultery and murder. It's shouting matches, it's passionate outbursts, and it reveals an out-of-control, undisciplined life. But sometimes spouses speak to each other that way. And you know, it may happen this way, that there's this intensity and it blows up. And then what happens usually after that? You make up. And there's a peace, or a peace treaty. But what's happened? Any of you guys work in forensics or in law enforcement, ever seen an explosion? You watch TV, you watch Hawaii 5-0 or something. You know, you see, and you have that, what happens after the explosion? There's a zone in which it goes, right? There's cleanup that has to be done because there's a lot of damage. There's a lot of collateral damage that's done. Let me say this. When you involve yourself in those kind of passionate outbursts, that clamorous activity, now we're going to have arguments. We're going to have disagreements. And if you say, I'm not going to have arguments or disagreements, you're not going to have a very long or healthy marriage, because it's just part of those two people coming together to be one. But if we don't fight according to the rules, we may make up, but we've done some damage. Got to be careful to make sure that we fight fair when we fight. That's being respectful. And the other one is lying that we'll deal with for the sake of time. Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 25. Again, Paul's speaking to the church, and he's talking about the new man. You've put off the old man, you're now the new man. And that new man is to put away lying and to speak truth, everyone with his neighbor. It's common to lie. And it's not just the big lies, it's the half-truths, it's the deceptions that Jesus talks about, but it shows a glaring lack of respect for the other person. It undermines it. So why is honesty so important in a marriage? I wish I had more time to go into that. But it's pivotal to intimacy. Intimacy is built on honesty. And intimacy leads to integrity, and so it underlies that intimacy. It's an integrity of a person who says, not just in this moment, but to make the big decision in all situations, I'm going to be honest. And that builds respect and is a reflection of respect. It's also pivotal to security. We might say if honesty is the cause of intimacy, security is the effect of honesty. If I know that you're telling me the truth, then I have a security that I ought to have. That's one of those basic needs and rights of a marriage. Proverbs 25 and verse 19 says, like a bad tooth and an unsteady foot is confidence in a person, confidence rather, in a faithless man in time of trouble. But if you're married to a faithless person, your time of trouble is all the time. But it's also pivotal to transformation. Romans 12, 1 and 2 says, as children of God, we are to be transformed. An atmosphere of distrust and dishonesty breeds resentment and jealousy and bitterness, depression, hostility. But an environment of truth and honesty gives us inner peace and joy and confidence and spiritual focus. I love this poem. They say that wife and husband, bit by bit, can rear between themselves a mighty wall, so thick they cannot speak with ease through it, nor can they see across it stands so tall. Its nearness frightens them, but each alone is powerless to tear its bulk away. And each dejected wishes he had known for such a wall some magic thing to say. So let us build with master art, my dear, a bridge of love between your life and mine, a bridge of tenderness and very near, a bridge of understanding strong and fine. Till we have formed so many lovely ties, there never will be room for walls to rise. You're building walls or bridges in your marriage, and a lot of that's based on how you speak to one another. Now, we also need to speak respectfully about our spouse, and we could build a list here. For the sake of time, let me give you one that's really common. It's gossip. You know, husbands and wives can fall into that habit together, can't they? Of gossiping about other people. But it can happen that we gossip about our spouse, right? Haven't you ever heard that happened with some couple somewhere? That they gossiped about their spouse? When do they do that? About what do they gossip? They go to a family member, they go to a close friend, and they talk about the problems in the marriage. They talk about their spouse, give their decidedly one-sided point of view. And here's what happens. They're upset. They want to do something. They want to get it off their chest. And so they go and they find that confidant and they talk to them and they give it, again, their side of the story. And at the end of that, things get better at home, right? But now what does that family member, what does that friend have in the back of their mind? What a low-down, sorry person that spouse is. You're trying to put things back together, but they have the lowdown on what your spouse has done. This is very damaging. The UK came up with a law known as the Dangerous Dogs Act of 1991. And they identified four breeds of dogs that were banned from walking the streets because they were dangerous to other animals or people. Three breeds I've never heard of, and of course the fourth one, pit bull. All right, so that these were four were outlawed. But they also had a provision in this law that if a dog that was not seen as a dangerous breed was to act dangerously or their owner was reckless in a result of an injury to another person or an animal, that they had to have a muzzle put on them. I don't know if you have a natural tendency to be volatile or if somebody could push the right button, you become that, and it shows up in your speech. But James chapter 3 says all of us need to have a muzzle all the time, especially with our mate. Because we're living with them the most. We're sharing the most life with them. And just very quickly, I want to touch on this. If we are going to be respectful, we've got to not only be respectful in our thoughts and our words, but if we've missed it in any way, we've got to be respectful in our behavior, in the way that we act toward one another. And here's what that means. It means that we've got to follow the golden rule. Luke chapter 6 and verse 31. And I'll talk more about this in another session, but it means I will never do in my mate's absence what I would not do in their presence. I'm going to think in terms of what I do being something I would not mind my spouse seeing me do. I'll protect my spouse from hurtful things that our children or other people might say to them. I'm going to come to his or her aid, and I'm going to think about how they need protecting. I will act so as to contribute to their joy and their security and their happiness. I'll make their marriage the best possible because that's what I want. We put others before ourselves. I'll save the development of that for another lesson. We will practice love. You know, husbands and wives both are commanded to love. Titus chapter 2, Ephesians chapter 5. And we will be faithful. And faithful means a lot more than sexual faithfulness. It means to be trusted in matters of our heart as well as matters of the body. And more we could say about that. But I want to end as I notice the time. I want to give you a break. You've been sitting here. I've been standing and moving around. I want to encourage you to pray for respect in heart, in word, and in action. You may wonder why that cow's up there. There was a well-traveled woman by the name of Patricia McGurr, and she would go around and collect stories in the Pacific Islands. And on one of her trips, she went to the island of Kinawada. And when she got there, she saw a note that had been entered into a ledger that said, Johnny Lingo paid 8 cows for his wife. And Johnny Lingo was the strongest, best-looking, most powerful man on the island of Kinawata. And he married a woman by the name of Sarita. And as he would talk to people, she would talk to people about that note, they would laugh, and it was a big joke. But Sarita had 8 cows paid for. You know, 2 to 3 cows was a fine price to pay for a woman in the Pacific Islands. 8 cows was unheard of. And they laughed and they said, she's a homely, meek, backward woman. Well, Johnny paid 8 cows for her and he took her to Nuramandi. Well, you know what Patricia did? She got into a canoe and she went over to Nuramandi. She wanted to meet Sarita. And she said she wasn't homely at all. Said she was graceful, she was charming, she was full of self-confidence. And so Patricia pulled Johnny aside when Sarita wasn't there. Said, tell me about this. This is not what I heard of on the island I just came from, Kinawada. He said, I love Sarita and her alone. And he said she had a reputation on that island that she just couldn't escape. And so I brought her here to Normandy. And she knows that she is the most valuable woman in all the islands. I wanted her as my own. And I wanted her to see herself as an 8-cow wife. You get the husband or the wife that you are willing to pay for. And if you give them self-respect, then you're going to have a treasure. But you see, it begins with what you do toward them and not what you expect them to do for you. David's going to, or somebody's going to pass out a sheet. What I'd like you to do, we'll give you, I don't know what I can give. We're going to quit at 8:30. I'm going to give you till 8 o'clock, if in addition to taking whatever you need to do in this break, if you'll spend a little time in filling out something that we're going to give. And if you need to fill it out here and there while I'm speaking in that second session, that's fine. But get that to me at the end of the night. There's instructions on there. If you'll give that to me before I leave, I'd be appreciative. But we'll consider ourselves, when you get your sheet, we'll consider ourselves in this break, and we'll come back about 8 o'clock.